In an attempt to update its image, Disney will produce a hardcore gay porno film. Unfortunately, two of its stars, Chip and Dale, will be tragically suffocated.
From two corners of the world, it's That's the Thing, the podcast dedicated to film where twin critics talk about, well, what else? Films. I'm your co-host, Nick. As always, with me is Alex. Alex, how are you doing back in good old Minnesota?
I'm doing just fine, don't you know, as they say.
Oh, you're darn tootin'.
Yeah, not much to report. Nice, lovely summer weather. Cool down after a nice storm. How are you doing over in jolly old England?
Well, you know, we've got kind of the same thing over here. We had a massive heat wave in the last week, and we had it in the low to mid-90s Fahrenheit. That's about 31 to 33 degrees Celsius for everyone else. And it was really difficult trying to get a good night's sleep before we got a huge thunderstorm on Thursday. Yes, Thursday evening. And then that has dropped things down to a much more manageable 60 degrees. So right now I feel like I'm kind of gearing up for September weather rather than summer weather. I'm just kind of got my little space heater on my back, got my little cup of tea, and my little jammy bottoms ready to talk about what is very much not an autumn movie, but a summer movie, because this is the second episode of our 2000s miniseries podcast. And this is an episode that I was really excited about, because this is something that I proposed to you, because you had never seen this movie before that we were going to be talking about today, correct?
Yeah, that's true. It's kind of the opposite of last week's episode, where I saw it before, but you hadn't. You know, it's the other way around.
Exactly. Exactly. And interestingly enough, both of these movies, I think they have, well, they have a few things in common, but they're very different on the whole. I mean, I think the one thing they have in common is that, well, if Steven Soderbergh stemmed from the American indie scene of the late 80s into the 90s, this film, in a lot of respects, marks the end of that indie scene and the beginning of kind of the 2000s indies scene, with stuff like Miranda July's Me, You, and Everyone We Know, Little Miss Sunshine to a much more mainstream extent. And the movie that we're going to be talking about today is David Gordon Green's directorial debut, George Washington.
Which is funny, because the title is one where even the director says George Washington has nothing to do with the film.
Well, it's really funny, actually. You know, Green was talking about kind of the significance of the title, and originally he asked his art director to provide a couple of portraits of George Washington in the film, and instead...
We got a different kind of George.
Yeah, we got portrait. You see portraits of George H.W. Bush in this film, which, when I first saw this movie about the better part of a decade ago, I thought to myself, oh, well, I wonder what that means. That's probably some sort of, is it a commentary on Bush-era politics? Is it a nostalgic evocation of Green's own childhood? Because, I mean, you know, he was an adolescent around the time Bush was president. But then I realized after the fact, no, it's just a joke. But, it's interesting that it's a humorous moment in a film that's, it's not without its comedic elements, but on the whole, it's a fairly serious film, and certainly much more serious than a lot of Green's later films, particularly some of his mainstream stoner comedies. But yeah, I mean, before we really get into this whole history of David Gordon Green, I mean, I have to be brutally honest, Alex, I haven't seen anything else David Gordon Green has directed, not even the new Halloween movie that he did a couple of years ago. Have you seen anything else that he's done?
I mean, yeah, I fortunately have not got around to seeing any of his dramas or comedies. Like, I haven't seen Undertow or Pineapple Express or Joe with Nick Cage. Yeah, not even his Halloween reboot that he did either.
Not even Your Highness?
Nope, not even The Sitter.
Well, so with that, I mean, in mind, I mean, then coming to this is kind of different than what we were talking about with Soderbergh last week, because Soderbergh was an auteur we were fairly familiar with his work. And Green is an interesting case where, again, he's somebody who, when he entered with George Washington was considered by a lot of critics when it first came out as something of a revelation. It was considered a a pretty unique and unusual American indie. I mean, it was famously rejected by Sundance, but it played in the Berlin Film Festival, and it sparked Green's career. For a few features after that, yeah, like you mentioned, Undertow, he made All the Real Girls and Snow Angels after that, and then he transitioned into mainstream comedy, much to everybody's surprise, because the last thing you would expect, looking at the pedigree of somebody who do mainstream stoner comedies, is somebody who is very much inspired by 1970s New Hollywood or late 60s avant-garde American cinema. And so, yeah, I mean, it's, I don't know how to place, you know, I mean, of course, we haven't seen his other work, so we can't really place it in relation to this movie. But looking at this film, what do you, I mean, when you finally got to seeing George Washington, what did you make of it? Because you've seen quite a bit of New Hollywood and 60s cinema. So you had, you know, a similar frame of reference to what Green and his collaborators had when they first undertook this project 20 years ago.
Yeah, I did. And, you know, what was interesting was there a couple of, like, New Hollywood cinema features that stuck in my mind as I was watching it. Like, primarily, of course, early Malick films, Badlands and Days of Heaven. But another film that also stuck out in my mind as I was watching it was The Last Picture Show. Because I think it was because of the ambience and the setting. Like, you have this kind of town that's down and dirty, right out. It kind of almost looks like it's in the process of, it probably will turn into a ghost town.
Well, that is what it was. I mean, because for context, for people who haven't seen George Washington, the film takes place roughly around the Salem-Winston city of Salem-Winston, North Carolina, and it follows the travails of a group of kids over the course of one summer, the landscape, it is kind of littered with abandoned tobacco factories, derelict buildings, but you comparing it to Malick should give the listener some sort of sense that this is not a miserablest film necessarily. In fact, what Green's sort of striving for is this sort of transcendental, ruminative, really contemplative style in this portrait of these kids.
Yeah, it is. And even straight down to, like, there's a voiceover narration that's done by this girl who is not the main character per se, but she has interactions with, I would say nearly, if not all of the major characters that are in the stories. And so it's her perspective and her kind of regaling about these people. And it's kind of like that sort of distant subjectivity that is kind of similar to that of the little girl in, especially in Days of Heaven.
Well, I was going to say, I mean, this is something that it completely took me by surprise. I don't know if you heard the news, but I just read this morning, right before we recorded this podcast, that yesterday, so the actress who plays the young narrator in Days of Heaven, Linda Manns, yesterday she actually just passed away at the age of 58.
What?
Yeah. I was very surprised, very saddened, because 58 is not a very old age. And I mean, it's something too that, like, you know, thinking about her in that film, I mean, for anyone who knows me knows that Days of Heaven is one of my absolute favorite films. I love that film. And to me, the film without her narration, which is a lot like Candace Evanovsky's narration in George Washington, where it somewhat comments on the action, but it also diverges, and it says a lot about the character's own sense of awareness, her own sense of processing the world. To me, Days of Heaven would not be what it is without Linda Manns' voiceover. And I think the same thing is true about Candace Evanovsky's voiceover in George Washington.
Yeah, I would agree with that. I feel like it really establishes the kind of tone of this whole picture, that voice. And what is interesting, and, you know, I listened to the audio commentary after watching the film, but I listened to Green's commentary that he did with, like, the cinematographer and with actor Paul Schneider, and what I found interesting was how he talked about how he liked having a narrator who would sometimes stammer or stutter through her lines, And there's this kind of like imperfection, and it feels authentic though, like this is a real kid who's telling the story. And you know, again, with that kind of maybe not a total reliability, because again, you know, this is somebody who isn't always present for everything that's going on, but maybe just picking up the pieces. And if I think it all ties into a degree of subjectivity, which I think of it influences the mood and the look of both Days of Heaven and George Washington.
Right. And specifically in the case of George Washington, the narrator herself, her perspective is also colored by the fact that the film, well, the film opens with her and another boy named Buddy breaking up. And the reason she's breaking up is because, as she says, she wants to have a more mature man, you know, even though he's 13 and she's 12, as someone points out. And the boy that she's interested in is George, whose last name is not Washington, but I mean, therein lies kind of the namesake, the linkage there, with the main character, and which is something we can talk about a little later too. But I mean, for the time being, the point being that this girl whose name is Nazia, Nazia's perspective in the film is colored by what she knows about both George and Buddy and the rest of the kids and her friends, really, and what she doesn't really know, or what she sort of is seeing play out beyond the confines of the screen of this summer that unrolls as we watch these kids play, interact, talk about girls, girls talking about boys, interacting with some of the adults in their town. There's not really a plot, except that there is a central event that occurs, which you and I had talked a lot about whether we were going to talk about that in this podcast. And we decided not to, because for people who haven't seen George Washington, I think it's best to go in as cold as possible, because that's what happened to you, right?
Yeah. I mean, and, you know, it's interesting because I think this incident which happens, I'll just say it kind of is reminiscent of a similar kind of events which occur in Days of Heaven and Badlands that sort of like are what we would call like the break of the routine, or they kind of set the plot into motion. Even though, yeah, Washington doesn't necessarily have like a grounded plot per se. It's more like a series of events and vignettes. But yeah, I think I didn't want to give this away either because of how it comes so swiftly, as Roger Ebert put it, that, you know, we are as shocked when it happens as the characters are.
Right. And when it does occur, I mean, I think you just said something about that it breaks the routine. I mean, I would go further and say that, I mean, along the comparison to Malick, it actually is sort of a rupture of this idyll. And what happens after that is the kids reckoning with that, and in their own ways, and growing separately from one another, and contending either explicitly or implicitly with notions of guilt, of responsibility, of morality, of their own place in the world. And it's something that I frankly, when I saw the film for the first time, and coming back to it now about a decade later, the thing that really struck me watching it again is that I think the strongest thing about this film, what really carries the film through, is just the effortless performances of these kids. I think all of them, I think what these kids do really well is balance what are sometimes these poetic monologues with what are fairly quotidian remarks. Sometimes they're off the cuff, and sometimes that they're scripted remarks as well. But I think there's never a moment in the film, I don't know about you, but did you feel like there was ever a moment where you felt like the kids were acting, or the kids were something felt disingenuous or forced about their performances?
No, I didn't. And I, yeah, there's so much praise to be given to the kids. And I think also to Green, I think credit has to be given to him for his faith and trust in those kids, and for collaborating with them as he does with all the actors, in which they work with a script but are also able to improvise and kind of morph and shape the scene so they could feel more authentic and natural. like, you know, one of the scenes I remember hearing about, like, it's actually early on too. It's shortly after the breakup that you mentioned. And another one of the kids who's very close with Buddy, he talks with the girl Candace and asks her, like, well, why are you breaking up with him? You know, and she's like, well, I just want somebody more mature. And it's like, are you seeing somebody? And it's like, yeah, I am. Who? George. He's like, George? But he's stupid.
Well, and the thing, I mean, the kid's name is Vernon. The actor who plays him, Damian Lee. I mean, I don't know about you, but for me, he was my favorite of the kid actors. I mean, I really was struck by him watching it again this time, just how effortless that kid is at handling a lot of really varying emotions in the film. Like, he has a lot of funny scenes, and then he has this one monologue where he actually kind of bares his soul, and the way he handles it is just, again, like I said, he's spouting what is sometimes poetic verbiage, but in a way that doesn't feel overly flowery or fussy. It just feels very organic.
I just want out of this. All my life, it's like I can't trust nobody, man. All my life, people have let me down. I just want to be by myself and just think about this. Think about what I'm going to do. Because I know I ain't standing around here. I just wish I had my own tropical island. I wish I could go to China. I wish I could go out of space, man. I wish I had my own planet. I wish there were 200 of me, man. I wish I could just sit around with computers and machines and just brainstorm all day, man. I wish I was born again. I wish I could get saved and give my life to Christ. Then maybe he'll forgive me for what I did. I don't understand you, man. Man, I just wish there was one belief, my belief.
And I mean, and him conveying the inner heartbreak and loneliness of his character, I think he just does a really magnificent job.
Oh, yeah, he does it beautifully. But he doesn't go overboard. It's more understated, but you feel that emotion. It's a very emotional and quite powerful performance. And yeah, no, it's amazing especially when you look at some of these kids, like you see the interviews with them and sometimes how similar they are to their characters and how different they are. So, and you, that makes, because it's easy to take for granted, oh, you know, these are non-professional actors, they're just kids. But then, yeah, when you see these interviews and you kind of are amazed and impressed at the performances they give, and they don't feel like generic movie kids performances, like, you know, like Green said, he didn't want them to sound like, you know, like he didn't want the kids to sound like young adults. He didn't want them to sound like the Olsen twins, and they don't. They sound like real people. They're authentic through and through.
Exactly. I mean, and I think, but it is also something where I think someone could take for granted that, oh, he just found these kids and he's just filming them as they are, and that's it. But I think, like you said, you know, looking at the cast talking, having a reunion like a couple of years after the film, you know, especially there's the young actor. Yeah, the actor who played George, his name is Donald Holden, and he, in terms of his personality, is very markedly different from the character of George, who's a very quiet kid. You know, the thing about George is that his fontella is not fully formed. So his skull is not fully formed, which means it's very soft and he can't, you know, he can't really itch it. He can't get it underwater. Otherwise it will irritate his brain. And I mean, that does come into play in a couple of key moments in the film. And again, like that, I mean, what's interesting about that detail is that it's something that it's a very, very fine, it's a fine detail that toes the line of being part of the everyday, but also of the unusual. And I think that if Green had pushed the unorthodox element of this, it could have veered a little too much into the precocious or the precious, and it could have actually, I think, have been, frankly, patronizing. I think the character of George, he's not a savant. He's not a kid who goes around and he changes a small town by espousing truths like Forrest Gump. I mean, even though he does dress up like a superhero, I mean, the film never forgets that he's a kid, but he's a kid who has a pretty deep reservoir of feelings. Wouldn't you agree, or what was your perception of him as kind of the protagonist, more or less?
Yeah, you know, George is an interesting character because of how he speaks so little, and especially, yeah, with Donald, with the real life kid, he was very much a talker. He was very much like a social kind of person. So to play that kind of a quiet character who keeps to himself was very difficult for him. And I think, though, he pulled it off beautifully in the end. But as a protagonist, I think he's kind of interesting because the journey that he goes through and how he decides to do things like try to become a superhero. And even though it looks kind of absurd with him, like, walking around downtown, like, with this white cape on and in tights or so, and with this helmet, which he always wears to protect his brain. But I think one of the key strengths to the entire film is the utter sincerity that we're able to buy with what's happening. Even though even when it comes at risk of coming off as twee or saccharine or silly, but it never toes over into that territory. And what I like about the character of George is how all the characters that, you know, are discovering about themselves and figuring out who they want to be or who they are, but I think of how he's shifting his own comfort zone and also figuring out what kind of person he wants to be to others in life. And by the end of the film, how he comes at a point where I think he's quite content. He's become quite content with who he is. And also with his relationship with his friends and also with his family, particularly with his uncle, Damascus, played by a Green collaborator, the late Eddie Rouse.
Right, right. And the character of Damascus, of George's uncle, is a really interesting character because for a lot of the film, he's a very taciturn fellow. I mean, he's just kind of in the yard of the house where George lives with his aunt and uncle and his sister. And he's just, you know, kind of in the junkyard. He's chopping wood. And you know, and the one thing that George has, he has this old dog, this old southern dog who has bumps and is diseased. And his uncle does not like dogs. And there's even a wonderful little conversation George has with his aunt at the dinner table where he's asking her, oh, does he like animals? And she's like, no, I don't think so. And he's like, well, does he like chickens? He likes to eat them. You know, and
like,
it's...
Does he like dogs? No. Why not? You know, they just bother him.
He just doesn't... They just bother him, I guess. And when the movie does get into why they bother him, it walks a very tricky tightrope of being both a poignant and sincere confession from Damascus and also something that has legitimate comic undertones. But I think what keeps it from veering too much into the comic is the sincerity and the real pathos, you know, coming from Rouse's performance. And I think this really is an actor's movie. I think it's a joy to watch not just the kids, but even the adults interacting with them, you know, because like you mentioned earlier, Paul Schneider is in this film and this is his first movie. And he's also a frequent collaborator with Green, but he's of course gone on to do other things like The Assassination of Jesse James. He was in Bright Star. For all you Parks and Rec fans, he's on that show. And he's kind of this like 25-year-old guy who really talks with the kids a lot. It's like him and a bunch of other guys, like another bunch of other white guys. And they just kind of, and again, the film, the one thing that struck me when I first saw this film is that I was kind of expecting like some sort of racial animosity, you know, between these older white guys and these young black, mostly black kids. And the film never does that though. The film is just very much just kind of content to observe these kids who are, you know, moving slowly into adulthood to these young adults who still remember what it's like to be kids, to just kind of shoot the shit and talk about things that they can all still somewhat relate to. Or when one of them's trying to impart some sort of token of wisdom, there's a great little exchange where Buddy is talking to one of Paul Schneider's character, Rico, one of his friends, and the friend's just asking, like, so how's your mom doing? Is she okay? You know, oh, yeah, she's been through a rough time, you know, man? And Buddy's like, yeah. And then he just asks him, so is your pee clear? I mean, it's just, you know, if it's, that's good, man. Then, you know, that means it's healthy. That means you're drinking plenty of water. And Buddy just replies, cool. And I mean, that's what any one of us would say in that situation.
Yeah. And what I like to is that with the dialogue and the performances is that with all the actors, because, yeah, I'm glad you also singled out, you included the adult actress as well, because I think everyone comes across as authentic and natural in their deliveries and performances. And I think also with the spontaneity, like you get, whether it's some of the talkback between these workers off at the railroad tracks or so, or between the adults and the kids, or just amongst the kids, there feels like almost a spontaneity in the delivery, and like some occasionally with the dialogue overlapping each other, and it kind of at times veneers Altman-esque, and almost like, and this is another film we mentioned last week too, but I think it shows just what a significant, inspiring film this is, but McCabe and Mrs. Miller.
Mm-hmm. Which I know Green has cited as a major influence, and it doesn't surprise me, because this does feel very much like, I mean, you're absolutely right on the Altman comparison, because it is very much like McCabe and Mrs. Miller, where that it's very much sort of, you're like a fly on the wall watching this community.
And I think the main character, even though he doesn't talk very much, I think George, too, has got poetry in him.
He does. He does. And that's, I mean, that's, again, the thing that's really quite lovely about the film is that all of the characters have poetry. And I mean, there's a wonderful scene, another scene with Buddy. I mean, he's a great character. And this kid, Curtis Cotton III, you know, he's another kid who, I think he was only in a PSA like 5 years ago for something. But like, why this kid didn't have a career as well, I don't know, because he is great. And he has this scene where he delivers something of like a makeshift soliloquy in an alligator mask in an abandoned theater or auditorium.
It's like, actually it was an abandoned elementary school, actually, where they shot this scene.
Oh, right. Yeah, exactly. So yeah, he's just giving this monologue, you know, of sorts, like a soliloquy. And then Paul Schneider just comes in applauding and just responds with the question, is that the Bible or Shakespeare?
Yeah, I love that line.
And it's a punchline, but it actually speaks to, like you said, the fact that all these characters have poetry in them, and they have this romantic sensibility too that doesn't ignore the setting of just the trappings of impoverishment in the community, or some of the more difficult and tragic elements that seep into the film.
I agree. You know, another thing I wanted to point out too, you know, speaking of locations, one of the things that I love too, and I think it's actually another trait that it shares in common with Traffic, actually from last week, which is interesting considering the significant difference in budget, but also to lend to that sense of realism and naturalism is the usage of real life locations, and which makes sense with George Washington, because it's a small, low budget independent film. I think they only shot on 50,000 feet of film, which Green said was the same amount he used for a 30-second PSA. So, but what I like is also the way it includes all these real locations and kind of lend themselves to the world that these kids inhabit. And it's not trying to romanticize impoverishment, I don't think, but it's like... it's like when you're looking back, like with the eyes of a child, like that sense of, I mean, it's a corny term to use, but like with nostalgia, and also just, you know, when you think about, when you're looking at things through a slight filter, and even through locations which maybe look, you know, down or dirty, but grungy, but these are just like natural environments for you, whether it's like, yeah, this place where there was a former like tire pit or so that was actually set on fire a couple of years prior to the shoot, or you have this what looks like an abandoned zoo with all these empty cages and so, and I think it really lends a lot to the world that these kids inhabit and these grown-ups too.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's. You know, I think what the film is doing is not utilizing if it has a wistfulness, it's not born from nostalgia, but it's more about, I think, a particular moment in a young person's life when they come to face the limitations of possibilities laid out for them. And those limitations can be set upon by external social forces. It can be set upon by tragedies that occur completely outside of our control. And in that ways, yeah, the film is a lot like Days of Heaven. It's also a lot like another movie that I know Green was really inspired by, which is Nick Rogue's Walkabout. And there are even a couple of moments in this film that there's a great moment in the film that involves just kind of this little brief interlude. It's about like a minute long, but it's an interlude that involves a tire yard or like an abandoned like a garbage dump.
Mm-hmm.
And you just see this brief insert of what was a snake that had been run over and it was dying, and the second unit of photography was photographing the snake, and it's shocking and it's grisly, but it's something like it does speak to just this visceral confrontation with death. That is something that is present in the film. And in a lot of ways, it's kind of retweaking of some of the tropes of, I would argue, the Southern Gothic tradition. You know, I mean, the Southern Gothic tradition, we come to kind of associate a little more with writers like Flannery O'Connor. You know, if you've ever read any of her stuff, like Wise Blood or Everything That Rises Must Converge, you know, there's this sort of, you know, there's always that dark, creeping, often grotesque element of the old American South, you know, and it's sort of the old South intersecting with the modern South in a way. And I mean, I don't think George Washington is strictly or purely a Southern Gothic film, because I mean, while it is dark and while there is a macabre element that underscores a lot of it. And in fact, I know that Green did take some inspiration from the Southern Gothic tradition. I mean, when he was having the character of Damascus, that was inspired by a Nick Cave book called And the Ass Saw the Angel, specifically this character who is a trapper who's constantly tinkering away at these sort of draconian traps that he sets for animals. I mean, so the tradition is there, but the difference is just that with the Southern Gothic, there is the more overt presence of ghosts and spirits. And this, it opts for a more metaphysical variation on that, which I think actually makes it unique. And also, it allows the film to retain something of what I would consider kind of a fundamental optimism. You know, I mean, it's a much easier thing to digest than something like Cormac McCarthy's Child of God, which, you know, if you've never read that book, that is a disturbing book. Or even like, you know, I mean, I'm thinking like it's interesting, some of the visual inspirations. There's a short film that I know Tim Orr, the DP, was inspired by, called A Day with the Boys. That
Yeah.
Oh, did you watch that?
Yeah, I saw that short.
Oh my God, it's so creepy.
Yeah, I mean, it's a I can certainly see, like, with the visually how it inspires the look of George Washington, but I would say it actually ends up becoming much creepier than Washington.
Well, exactly, and that's the thing, you know, like it has kind of the ethereal wistfulness in terms of the visual style of A Day with the Boys, you know, and even some of the melancholic undertow of Walkabout and the Malick films, but. I mean, I think what differentiates it from a lot of those works is something akin to optimism. Is that something that you would agree with then? Or do you think the film, or how did you perceive that strain of hopefulness?
You know, it's interesting because I wasn't necessarily thinking optimistic when I was watching the film, but I wasn't thinking pessimistic either.
Mm.
I think it's more like a fine balance, because I think even though I was alluding to George as being somebody who I think finds kind of his calling in life and finds happiness with himself and with the people he loves, there's even a nice little moving moment where he visits his dad in jail and tells him, like, he finally understands.
Yeah.
And how he tells him that, I love you more than I can say.
Yeah, I mean, that moment too, I mean, he just says something like as basic as, I love you so much that, you know, sometimes I can barely breathe. And it, you know, on paper, you would imagine the scene would be so cornball and so and so just cloying. And yet somehow it's it just I don't I agree with you. I think it's such a touching moment.
But I think there are other characters too who I think whether you could say, oh, but they kind of figure out who they want to be or what they want to do in life. But I feel like there are characters who are not necessarily in a good position by the end of the film, you know? There are some who maybe kind of cut themselves off from everyone. And I think that's sort of... So I think it's kind of... I think it's a balance in terms of, you know, I guess it's pragmatic in the sense that it's realistic for this is how, for character motivation, this is how the characters would act. It would make sense that these would be the choices they would make.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's a fair point. I mean, I think the film is, I think it's interesting to compare. One comparison we haven't brought up yet, but I think it's a very clear touchstone. Is the work of Charles Burnett.
Ah, yeah.
And I mean, and clearly, like, I know Killer of Sheep was a huge influence on this film as well. And you know, the weird thing is, I've only recently gotten into Charles Burnett in the last couple of years. I still haven't seen Killer of Sheep, which I know is kind of sacrilege because that film is a classic.
But well, I haven't seen either.
But I've seen My Brother's Wedding and To Sleep with Anger. I mean, both of which are terrific films. And, you know, especially like watching something like My Brother's Wedding. It's a lot. I can see the influence of Burnett on George Washington in the sense that, like you said, like both Burnett and Green are willing to just kind of observe the characters who are fully realized, see them make decisions which lead them towards particular paths, and not judge them on where they are by the end of the film. They just sort of remark upon whether they've grown, whether they've not grown, how much they can change, how much they haven't changed. I mean. I do think that Charles Burnett has a little more irony in him, though. You know, especially with something like To Sleep with Anger is a much more dryly ironic film. I mean, even though it's a very sweet film.
It ends on a very darkly comic punchline.
Well, exactly. Exactly. You know, whereas George Washington doesn't quite go that route. But I mean, I would argue that what George Washington does is that it doesn't, I mean, regardless of what happens to its characters by the end of the film, you know, some are maybe in better places than others, but ultimately the film doesn't, and I don't think Green by extension wants to condemn any of these kids towards a fate, a prescribed fate. I think what the film is striving for is this sense of, even though I was talking earlier about that age when children sort of encounter the limits of possibility imposed upon them, there is kind of this idealist, almost utopian component towards the film's reason of being or its motivation, which is just that there is all like it's hoping for this ideal to be realized by these kids, that there's. That when these kids have the opportunity to really realize the extent of what they're capable of the goodness that they possess, then that's what makes that community such a strong place to live in. It's what makes America a good place to live in. I mean, and the thing is, again, this all sounds hopefully naive, especially in 2020. But I don't know. Do you think that if that is what the film is going for, do you think that makes it seem mawkish in the era of Trump?
No, I don't think it makes it look mawkish or naive. I think it's hopeful. And yeah, it's interesting because we had a little bit of like qualms with the hopeful end note of Traffic. But I think here it works because, again, it's... I think, you know, one of the key factors that I think makes Washington so distinguished in everything we've talked about regarding the film is its utter sincerity. And I think sincerity is not the same as saccharine or cheesy. And my mind keeps going back to, you know, thinking about something that Schneider said in the commentary at the end of the film, which he said he kind of wished there were more movies that were more sincere, and how he was getting sort of tired of all these movies that were kind of just trying to be ironic and to get a laugh out of the audience with, you know, with horrible things happening. Like, he singled out Pulp Fiction. And I thought about that, and I was thinking about a lot of the indie films, and even some like notable titles being made during that time, which had this sort of post-irony to them that we associate so heavily with that time period that were being made, like Pulp Fiction, or even in genre titles like Scream. And here comes a movie, George Washington, which is elegiac, it's eloquent, poetic, and utterly sincere by all means. And I think that could be almost disarming for some people, but I think it's also, I think through the sincerity, I think it really opens up to the humanist side of us, and which I think is actually quite beautiful and inspiring. It makes us, you know, to make us be so empathetic with this world and this community, and I think it could make you in tune, like, say, if you're going outside into the world and you notice these things, like, and makes you kind of aware of the fragility of life and death through things like the roadkill snake, I'm glad you singled out, or other things like that. And it kind of, it makes you treasure and to value not just human life, but all life.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, I think, I am kind of curious about how the film would play in a Black Lives Matter era. Because, I mean, I think, well, I mean, you know, there was a big controversy with Steven Spielberg directing The Color Purple back in 85. And we were talking about Charles Burnett earlier. And, I mean, Charles Burnett is one of those great filmmakers who, sadly, I mean, he really has only made a very small number of movies because he's just never really gotten funding to make his movies. You know, and it's, well, and then again in 93, in the midst of this, in the American indie scene that you're describing, which I think you're completely spot on about the postmodern irony that was so prevalent during that time, we had the first film directed by an African-American woman director, Daughters of the Dust. And the fact that it took that long for an African-American woman director to make a feature film in America, it still boggles the mind. I mean, some people will look back on that and say, oh, that was nearly 30 years. Yeah, they'll say, like, oh, that was nearly 30 years ago. But in the context of George Washington being released, that was really not that long ago.
And it's hard, it's easy to forget, but there are also, like, African-American directors making movies as far back as the silent era.
Well, absolutely. If you go all the way back to Oscar Micheaux, and a lot of the great stuff that he was doing, including the stuff he did with Paul Robeson and also Within Our Gates. Yeah, I mean, it's African-American filmmakers have been a presence for a great deal of cinema's history. But there's always the trickiness, I think, about when a white director is making a film about, well, I think anybody who's making a film about a community that maybe they're not specifically, they don't specifically belong to, if they're kind of an outsider, but then they're trying to have, you know, a view from the outside in. And because there's always the danger of that veering into aestheticizing components of quotidian living for the subjects of the film. And so there, you know, and I could see somebody leveling charges against George Washington about aestheticizing the poverty of these kids. You know, I mean, it's kind of a similar quandary with a very different filmmaker, Pedro Costa. And I mean, in his films, when he's, a lot of his films that are about the denizens of the Fontanhas neighborhood in Portugal, a lot of migrants from Cabo Verde, that they're very highly theatrical and stylized in terms of the lighting, but they're all non-professional actors. And a lot of the stories and the scenarios, really, they're not even scripts, they're scenarios. They're drawn from their real lives. And there's always that distinction about, well, is this exploitation? Is it trying to dispel stereotypes commonly associated with these sorts of stories? Is it somebody exploiting the situation for their own career gain? Or is it somebody who's actually trying to show a sense of solidarity, you know, and even affection for others who we might not even consider necessarily in the same community? Because I know that Green, I mean, this was, again, shot in a lot of the areas around the film school where Green was studying in the mid-90s. And he met a lot of people in that neighborhood. And, you know, and he made a lot of friends there, again, with Eddie Rouse and Paul Schneider and the cast and crew. And, I mean, it was a lot of extensive collaborations and discussions with them about their characters. And, I mean, I don't know. I mean, in your opinion, do you think that the film... How do you think the film fares now? I mean, this is a very long-winded way to approach this basic question, but how do you think the film fares in 2020 as a story about Black Lives Mattering?
I mean, yeah, it's a delicate question to answer, but I would say that, you know, I'd start off by saying, like, you asked, does the film aestheticize or romanticize poverty? And as I was kind of alluding to earlier, I don't think it does. I think they just shoot it the way they do because, again, it's that subjectivity of you when you're a child and you're looking back on those years of your life, or, you know, there's a certain period of your life which would be informative and influential. You know, it have the effect on you and kind of shape you into the adult you become, you know, good and bad. But I don't think it's trying to romanticize or anything. It's just, it's a mixture of subjectivity, but with that slight bit of, because of looking back into the past, there, you know, it's a little bit of a heightened realism. But also in terms of it in regards to the Black Lives Mattering, I think it would, in some ways, be considered empowering because, you know, when you have the title character, again, how he wants to become a superhero. And it's like he's not doing it just to be, you know, just to save white kids, even though he does save, you know, a white kid in a crucial scene. But it's not just for the fact of him doing this in servitude of gaining white approval, but he does it for his own self. It's like for his own catharsis. And I also feel like the fact that, yeah, since Green is a white director who's primarily focusing on mostly black kids, I think he's trying to showcase a sense of empathy and trying to make he's not trying to necessarily dictate how things are, but he's just, again, he's taking an observational stance. And I think that ties into the way he also collaborates with his actors in this movie.
Yeah. You know what? I agree with you. I mean, from my perspective, as somebody who grew up in Minneapolis, I don't know what the, I can't speak to the personal experience of what these kids experience growing up in North Carolina. But what I do think is apparent on screen is what you were talking about in terms of Green's collaboration with his actors, in terms of helping them really bring forth a sense of spontaneity, of freshness, of genuine sincerity. And then also incorporating a lot of the regional and geographic specificity in a way that doesn't feel cloying or trite, but it feels true. And also the way that, for example, in the film, there's a component involving baptism. And the way that, you know, it appears in one scene when George and Buddy go to church and they're kind of watching a sermon. We see kind of this brief flashback of George getting baptized. And you know, it sort of seems like, you know, when you're watching it at first, you're like, oh, okay, this is just a little detail about their lives, you know, and it seems like it makes sense for, you know, that this kid would get baptized. But then the film takes that iconography, the water iconography, and it takes it into some interesting places, and it turns it into, again, a question of rebirth, renewal, of redemption, really. But in a way that doesn't feel forced. It's very much, and it's also about kind of that cleansing of trauma, about that sense of letting go and or taking to task what's happened in your life, but being cleansed of that and being able to move forth into realizing, again, the best part of yourself. And I mean, I do think it's what makes the film very melancholic but not despairing, and again, hopeful and even idealistic, but not altogether naive. And I mean, I think it'd be really interesting to see how it plays 20 years from now again. But I mean, I do agree with you that personally, I think, you know, it by and large attains a very timeless feel. And it does raise a question about who the film's audience is, or who the intended audience is. And I know Green was saying in some interviews that, you know, he was intending for a lot of audiences to come away from the film and to kind of take their own thing from it. But it's one of those things that I think it does reflect this component of the year 2000 that we were talking about last week, where there is this sense of this transitory feeling of the millennium not really settling in, and the cynicism that really would come to the fore, and even like the return of that irony, or kind of that sort of remove, you know, that hip remove from the characters and the stories of a lot of these indie films. I think George Washington still embodies a lot of the hopes and ideals for something of an America that can exist. The only question is, what can we do to make that a reality and not just a movie?
Yeah, I really think that George Washington ties into that sort of era that people have referred to as New Sincerity. I think it really is a work that could be categorized as New Sincerity, because it's utterly sincere with its story, its characters, its messaging, and its themes. And I feel like, and I love how, as you put it, how it's both melancholic but not despairing. You know, so there's a sense of hopefulness to it too. And I think that I think about the closing montage of the film, which there's a closing montage involving these black and white photos of major American figures, including, of course, George Washington. But I think the purpose, what I got out of that closing montage, was about how, you know, these figures, who in truth are complex human beings and have their severe flaws, but with the way we mythicized them, and the way they inspire and influence kids, you know, today, I feel like we, as we grow up hearing these stories, we can morph and shape them into ourselves and use them to inform ourselves of what kind of people we want to be in this world, and what kind of future we want to bring. And since there are so many impassioned youth here today who are trying to fight for equal rights, for safety, for health care, for environmental protection.
Basic human dignity.
Yeah. And so I feel like George Washington would actually still have a place for an audience today, 20 years later.
Yeah, I think so. I mean, it's a good film to watch in terms of, as you said, dispelling a lot of the cynicism. I think that I think a lot of us are really feeling right now, and not for no good reason, you know, because these are very difficult times. And I think it's nice to watch a film that provides, again, this portrait of life that isn't perfect or naive, but it does consider the way that we can try to live together and still try to band together around tragedy and not be isolated. I think in a lot of respects, actually, it's a really great film to watch in the COVID era, you know, when people are feeling very isolated and very fearful of each other and very resentful of just a lot of the jingoism and the bigotry and the prejudice rhetoric that's dominating a lot of popular discourse. I mean, just the sheer politicization of basic services like the United States Postal Service. When we have a film that's providing people a sense of something that exists beyond a very easy or pointed or didactic political agenda, but it's not a conciliatory, and it's not trying to be a simple concession to make white folks feel good about themselves. It is a story about these kids and their childhoods. It's their story.
No.
And Green understands that and he respects that, I think.
I think he does too. But I think, you know, just like how there are many stories we get from major historical figures and maybe not so major, but still people that maybe we know personally or so, it's their stories, but they can still have an effect on us. And yeah, I think that makes it actually a very beautiful film. And you're right, I think a perfect film to watch in the age of COVID.
But for now, I think it's pretty safe to say that, you know, as somebody who's seen George Washington, I really liked it a lot the first time I saw it. Coming back to it again, I still like it a lot. I still think it's very much worth seeing. What did you, I mean, as somebody who came to it for the first time, I presume that you felt similarly?
I would highly recommend it. I think it's one of those films that I think I even admire the more I talk about it. You know, I'm really glad we have this discussion, but even as I was watching it on an initial basis, like, it has this hypnotic, transcendental quality to it. It makes you feel like you're walking through a dream, and it's like a dream of a memory, but it transports you to this time and this place. And even though it's great that Green didn't want to necessarily specify too much about location or time, despite the picture of George Bush Sr. But I think, you know, I think that, again, that universality is what would make it so appealing. And I think that that ability to transport people, that's one of the reasons I love movies so much, is to be able to take you to a place for 90 minutes or 2 hours or whatever time it is. And then when you get out of it, it lingers with you. So yeah, I love it for that. I highly recommend it.
And I think, again, just to bring it back to the George Bush portrait, which we talked about earlier, it's a joke, but at the same time, it's a transubstantiation in a lot of ways of this mythic ideal, which can be naive in a lot of respects, but it's also something worth striving for. And hopefully we'll see, you know, we haven't found its ideal with the real George Washington. We certainly didn't find that with the real George Bush. Maybe we'll find it with this George or some other George in the future. You know, anything's possible. We just have to keep working towards that. I think that's what George Washington, the film, leaves us with. And I think that's a really beautiful thing.
Yeah, I think so too. Well, you know, I thought maybe now would be a good time for us to talk a little bit about other movies we might have seen during this past week. And if you don't mind, I thought I'd start off first because because this, in a way, connects to George Washington, because it's also a film about a superhero, and also ties into truthfulness, or as the director would like to use as a mantra for the crew, verisimilitude. And that movie is a film that maybe you guys know about. It's 1978 Superman, the movie.
Isn't that a prequel to Superman Returns?
I'm not going to answer that question.
I'm sorry. That's the only time I'm going to reference that movie in this podcast, I promise.
Yeah, there are some less than appealing Superman films we may or may not reference, but yeah, like, I sat down, I saw it again, and it was kind of cool because I actually saw it with a family member. I'd seen it once before. Like, I remember I was 14 years old. You and I saw it together. It was the summer of 06. It was when Superman Returns was coming out. And I don't know about you, but I remember I kind of loved the film, actually, when I saw it. I would see clips again of it on the internet or so, and I'd look back on it with this high fondness. So I finally sat down again and saw the whole thing in one sitting once more, but I saw it with a family member who had never seen it before, and though she loves some of this director, Richard Donner, some of his other movies. She loves also The Goonies and Lady Hawk. And what was interesting was at, you know, when the movie was over, I turned to her and I asked, "So what'd you think of it?" And what she said was, I found very interesting. She said, "You know, I love watching some of these old movies because, you know, there's like two or three things going on in this movie. And nowadays you have like 25 things going on." And I thought that was a very interesting observation made. And I think that kind of, it attributes to that certain time period of like the way movies were being made from then, as opposed to the way movies are made now. But I think also it ties to one of the strengths of the film, of what I love so much, particularly in the first half of the film, is the way it takes time to build up character with Superman's backstory. When you see him growing up in Smallville to, you know, going to the Fortress of Solitude, to eventually when he moves to Metropolis and when he becomes Superman.
Right.
And, you know, And it really works as a strong character study that it almost overshadows the second half. Not that I think the second half is bad. It's just sometimes it gets a little slow. Like another family member who was watching with us was kind of like, they thought, oh, the second half was so long. And I'm like, yeah, it gets a bit long, but I still didn't mind. You know, I respect, especially the way it shows things like, I love that sequence when he and Lois Lane are flying, which of course has been either mimicked or spoofed by so many people, but you know, it's still a nice romantic scene, you know, because especially with the beautiful music by John Williams.
Oh yeah.
And I think it works the way like it builds up with these character relationships and how it ties into this climax that's not only high in action but high stakes in emotion as well. Like even you know, when we're watching it, saying afterwards, saying how, like, you know, even this family member hadn't seen before, met, she felt, would, you know, felt a lot of stress and tension seeing, like, you know, this person being suffocated by all the sediment falling on them. And I think you know, I think that's, those are some signs of like a good movie. I don't know if it's a great film because I think of the pacing, and also because it has its corny moments, which I don't think have held up all that extraordinarily well. Even though what was funny was you did giggle at a lot of Ned Beatty's antics. Who, Ned Beatty, God bless him, you know. He's a good character actor.
Oh, yeah. I love Ned Beatty. He's great. He's been in a lot of really great things over the years. I think you and I have talked about Superman the movie, you know, for a lot, many, many times. And we've had long conversations about Donner's version of Superman and Superman 2, the whole kind of brouhaha around the production of that film, but to bring it specifically to the original Superman, I think you really, I'm in complete agreement with you about the film. I think the first half is the best half of the film, because I remember also the first time I watched it. What's great about it is that it proceeds at a very deliberate pace of unveiling this origin story, and it is very much it's dependent upon the acting. And again, this is a really great cast. You have some heavy hitters like Marlon Brando and Glenn Ford as both of Clark Kent's fathers. And they both do amazing work in this film. And it gives the story that sense of gravitas that does kind of jar a little bit with the goofiness of the second half. And so, I mean, and the goofiness, of course, which culminates in that infamous climax with Superman spinning the world backwards, which everybody knows would not work. It's complete bullshit, and I still have problems with it, but you know
what's interesting?
What's that?
What's interesting is that, you know, when I was asking about this family member, like, what they thought about the ending, I was like, well, did you find it ridiculous or anything? And she's like, you know, I didn't mind so much, you know, because, you know, there's a little bit of magic in there, what have you. And I was thinking about the ending too, because, yeah, the ending is ludicrous. But I think I've slowly come to terms more with the ending, because I think of how it ties into the journey the character takes, because of how he is given this advice by his two father figures, and he tries to figure out, like, whether it's like, I know you're here for a reason, or it is forbidden to interfere with human history. But then how at the end he decides to take what he wants to take, and he becomes his own person. He carves out his own destiny and knows what kind of person he's going to be on this earth, and to the people that, especially the people he cares and loves. Yeah, so I mean, so I guess with that, I think that kind of softens it a little bit for me, even though I do think it is ludicrous. Like, he goes at ludicrous speed. But what I still liked about it too, seeing it again, what I loved about it so much seeing the first time was, I think there's a lot of, and I'm glad you point out the gravitas, because I think there's a lot of love and passion for this. You can feel it, I think, throughout the whole movie. Like, there is a genuine love for the source material, and, like, especially Donner felt like he would sign on to the task of going, okay, I am going to tell the story, but I'm going to give it the respect and it deserves for this American icon. Because so many of us grew up reading it and we love this character. And I feel like you can feel that. And I think it's stuck with so many people, and that's why it's been so influential. I mean, like, if there was, without Superman, we wouldn't have Tim Burton's Batman or the MCU, or certainly not Sam Raimi's Spider-Man trilogy, which also tried to find that balance between pathos and gravitas and goofiness, even though I don't think that quite worked out, especially in the third movie.
Especially in the third movie. Oof.
Yeah. But still, I think that's why people would go revisit it, and I still think there are things about it which still inspire me and kind of remind me about their components or elements that, again, of my personal views of what I love, you know, of the kind of movies I'd love to make, you know, the kind of movies that can thrill, that can excite, can make people laugh or make them awe and wonder.
It's not, yeah, I mean, that is the great thing about the original Superman, is that it isn't, it does differ from a lot of contemporary blockbusters that are manufactured, really, to tick a lot of boxes in terms of catering towards demographics, also towards being part of a multi-strand franchise. And keeping up with the Marvel Cinematic Universe is exhausting. I don't know about you, but it's not fun to me, because it is such a, I mean, there are some good Marvel films, don't get me wrong, but I mean, the whole venture is predicated upon you watching every single film. And you just keep consuming and consuming, consuming, consuming. And after a while, the entire saga, you know, it just sort of blurs into this giant mass of extravaganza and spectacle.
It becomes a money monster.
It is a money monster, absolutely. And I think what, you know, our family member was saying about, you know, these movies having different strands, that's because it is. They do have all these different strands. They're constantly trying to draw you into the next thing, into the next film, into the next film. And the nice thing about Superman the movie, of course, it does lead into the second film, but as a film on its own, it really works well. It's charming. It's fun. It has a great, great Clark Kent and Superman. You know, very fun Lex Luthor with Gene Hackman. You know, it's a great popcorn movie.
And also, you know, other people too, you know, there are a lot of like great actors in there, like Margot Kidder and Jackie Cooper. But yeah, I'm glad you singled out Christopher Reeve, because I think he is the one who completely carries the movie, and he holds up 110%.
Absolutely.
What I love about his performance in it, and what I think isn't, you know, again, so inspirational, influential for so many people, is the way he distinguishes between Superman and Clark Kent. Because you look at the comics, and you see Kal-El in his Clark Kent getup, and it's like, how could anybody not notice or realize that's Superman? But I think his whole idea of making him kind of this, you know, dweebish, stuttering nerd who channels Cary Grant, I think was kind of a stroke of genius, and that way he could be able to contrast himself so starkly with Superman, even with his body language. And there's that great moment where, after the romantic flight, when he comes at Lois's apartment as Clark, and she goes to the bathroom to get ready, and he takes off his glasses, and it's even, you know, Reeve, you know, who's acting so good, like, he looks at himself with the glasses, and then he's got a smile, like he thinks, you know, maybe I can do this. I can tell her who I really am. And you even see when he shifts his body language, it's like then he goes into his Superman persona before then he decides he changes his mind swiftly and puts back on the glasses.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
That's great.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, now I want to watch the original Superman again at some point. Thanks a lot, Alex.
Oh, you're quite welcome.
Yeah. I've got esoteric art house movies that are just stockpiling on my to watch list. Nothing major in terms of popcorn films or blockbusters lately. But yeah, it's good to revisit the classics.
It is good, you know. And sometimes you can have art house pictures that are esoteric. You can have popcorn films that are esoteric. Just look at Christopher Nolan. But as long as, I mean, directed ones, not ones he produced, like that one Superman film he produced.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly. In the meanwhile, leave notes in the comments about if you've seen George Washington. What do you think about the film? Do you think it's aged very well? How do you feel like it's would operate within the context of the present here in America's political climate? And how do you think it compares to other David Gordon Green movies? Is there a better David Gordon Green movie than George Washington? Now that would be an interesting question to answer. I would love to see somebody very sincerely make the case that Pineapple Express is the superior, or Your Highness is the superior film to George Washington.
I was going to say, I would love to see somebody make the case about The Sitter.
Well, if there's the one person who really likes The Sitter out there, feel free to roast us in the comments. Let us know what you think. Also, before we go, Alex, there's one thing I forgot to mention, or that we did forget to mention, about one thing about Eddie Rouse's filmography. Unfortunately, Eddie Rouse also passed away about 6 years ago. But he did, he was still a notable character actor in quite a number of things. Like, he was in Westworld, and he was in a number of other David Gordon Green productions. And of course, linking it back to an earlier podcast that we did, he did have a small role in the 2002 comedy classic, Juana Man. So, does this mean that we have to do a Juana Man episode? Perhaps, perhaps not. Time will tell.
Maybe you can tell us in the comments.
It, for all the Juana Man fans out there, you know, I know...
The Juana fans.
Juana fans, exactly.
With two N's.
Well, as always, thank you so much for joining us. We look forward to next week's installment of our ongoing series about the year 2000 with movies. But until then, be well, stay safe, and keep watching great movies.
Take care, everyone. We're all in this together. Watching me fly.